The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah.
Yes.
Yes.
And all the other holidays.
Happy Kwanzaa for those who celebrate. And happy solstice. Oh my goodness, we're going to get to see more light. How exciting is that? I live for that sunshine and light. And we have not seen much of that this week, have we?
No, and we haven't seen a lot of snow either, so.
No, we haven't. We really can't complain about that. So holiday shopping is, fill in the blank.
Is not fun.
That wrong answer. All right. I have to make a correction to something I said last week.
Okay.
So we talked about the opportunity that arose out of our conversation with Marilyn Price for a new Trips for Kids chapter. And I said it was Ron Girth who contacted her. I was wrong. It was Rob Guskey. And he is the guy who works at Kimberly Clark and runs the challenge.
Got it.
I feel so much better. Okay. We actually might have two great gift ideas for you this week with our guests.
Okay.
The first is a link, so you could get that right away. It's to a really interesting and very well-produced documentary, Half the Road, The Passions, Pitfalls, and Power of Women's Professional Cycling. It was written, produced, and directed by Catherine Bertin. Catherine started out as a figure skater. She has competed in triathlons, was a writer for ESPN, raced in the 2013 UCI Women's Road Race in Florence, Italy, and is currently a member of the Wiggle Honda Women's Cycling Team. So we've spoken quite a bit about the issues that women have been facing in pro cycling many times in the past 4 years, and Catherine pretty much wraps all that up in a neat package in a 1 hour and 52-minute movie. It is narrated by ex-pro racer and Tour de France announcer Bob Roll, Bobki as he is affectionately known. And it has excellent music, lots of guests and interviews. Half the Road lays out the issues with glaring clarity while offering a pretty realistic view into what women cyclists face today. Even our friend Inga Thompson is part of this movie. So the link is available on Vimeo. There are a couple of options. There's a 72-hour, very inexpensive download, so you can download it and take your time watching it. And then there's a keep it in your system for always download for a bit more money. But either way, the hour and 52 minutes might be a really nice gift for somebody, and it's a good insight into what's going on in women's cycling. Then we're going to take a short break and do a little bit of news. We'll be back to speak with professional triathlete coach, motivational speaker, and author Mark Cleanthus. Mark has competed in and finished more than 1,050 triathlons, marathons, and ultra-endurance events. He is the author of The Complete Book of Triathlon Training, and his new book, Triathlon, The Mental Battle, gives you all the ammunition you need to conquer the demons that plague an athlete mentally when racing or training. And there are a lot, I think. From positive imagery to a litany of A to Z negative words that we tend to use that could end up sabotaging our goals, Mark gives you a lot of tools that you might need to train and compete. So let's head on out to Arizona. We're going to speak with cyclist and film producer Catherine Bertin. Catherine, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for producing a great film, Half the Road. We've heard about it, we've talked about it, and now I got to see it this week. I really, really like it a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's so nice to hear.
No, well, I think that you did a really good job with it, and I want to get through a lot of it in the time we have. So, but first, give us a little bit about your background and how you became involved in women's cycling.
Sure. I'll give you the nutshell version, because otherwise it's a pretty lengthy story. But I had been a professional triathlete and a journalist. And I got an assignment from ESPN back in 2006 to see what it would take to get to the Olympics in this modern day and age. And since I did long-distance triathlon, and that was not an Olympic sport, I decided to try road cycling and switched over from triathlon to road cycling and fell so in love with the sport that even long after the assignment ended, I was personally smitten, and I just said, I want to make a go of this, and I want to see if I can get to the highest level and turn professional and really make it my life. So that's how I got into the sport.
Put that in the context of time.
Okay, so my first year was riding on the road. It was 2007, and I was strong, as you know, coming from a strong background in triathlon, I was able to cat up from Cat 4 to Cat 1 in about 9 months. But that put me in the realm of being a Cat 1 cyclist with no clue what I was doing tactically. So
you were good enough and you weren't good enough. I got it.
Right. I was strong enough, but not smart enough. So, and as anyone in the sport knows, that education is something you can only learn in time. You know, how to actually be a good road cyclist. So that was my personal kind of aha moment of, oh, I love this sport. It's ever changing. I want to see what I can do. So I stayed in it, and I got my first pro contract was with Cola Vita in 2012. So for the past 3 years, I have the last 3 seasons I've raced professionally, and hope to continue to do so.
I would assume you will. That doesn't seem to be an issue. Weren't you picked up by a different team for 2015?
Yes, I raced for Wiggle Honda, and it's a fantastic organization run by Rochelle Gilmore, and just fantastic riders from all across the globe. So I'm very, very fortunate to represent such a great team.
So you decided you would use your journalism background, and you made this documentary, this 1 hour, 52-minute documentary, Half the Road. The premise of the movie is the women's lack of equality in professional cycling, basically, especially in the media, the opportunities to race, and in their paychecks.
Yep.
Do you have a personal opinion on why women are being treated the way they are in cycling, given what we know about how cycling was, say, 30 years ago when the likes of Connie Carpenter and Inga Thompson and Jeannie Longo were racing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really think the root of you know, all causes here is just ignorance and perhaps chosen ignorance on behalf of the UCI and the governing bodies. This is, you know, a sport that is so steeped in the good old boys network that, you know, they are not seeing at the top levels, you know, they're not seeing the potential that women have to bring to the sport, you know, financially lucrative investment, everything that a business model should include. So they just kind of look at the sport and say, well, men have always been the pinnacle of this sport, and that's the way it's going to continue. And that's what we try to argue in the film, is say, hey, wait a minute.
Right.
You know, this is 2014. Things are different now. And we always look to tennis as the, you know, the example of a sport that was also steeped in the good old boys network and then completely revamped their structure thanks to Billie Jean King and her, you know, cohorts. And now look at it. Now look at how phenomenal the whole tennis industry is, both men and women. So that's our basis. That's our model for what we can be in cycling.
Juliet McCoy wrote a very interesting, and I'm sure you read it in the New York Times, her sort of opinion piece. But I came up with this idea that why maybe shouldn't we nominate a woman to head USA Cycling and maybe change it in our country?
I love that idea. I love the thought. And here's my take on that. I believe, if you know, when we're calling for something like gender equity, whether it's in sports or business or any realm of life, we have to be equal all across the board. I actually think there's a phenomenal number of men that would be perfect for the position of creating equality for the women. You know, there's a lot of smart young men that understand, you know, what the women can achieve. Just as I feel that there's a lot of women that also, you know, can fill that position. So when we say, hey, shouldn't there be a woman at the top? You know, I'm going to be the first to say I would love that to be the theory, but I've also known a lot of women who are not equipped in terms of fronting an equality movement because they themselves might not feel equal and therefore can't lead by example.
It's an interesting point. Very interesting point. Yeah, I guess my thoughts went to bringing somebody in who had no real association with the underlying network of what Steve Johnson is walking away from when he leaves next year.
Yeah, true. I do think that there are plenty of retired female cyclists that would serve that position very well.
Well, we just put it out there, right?
Yeah, let's put it out there.
Right, exactly.
Job hunting. I'll throw my resume.
There you go. There you go. You still are on the road, Missy. I'm sorry. You have to keep riding.
Well, that is thank you. But, you know, it's interesting because one of the things Cookson ran on in his platform was, you know, hey, I've appointed a female vice president.
Right.
You know, in Tracy Godfrey. And Tracy Godfrey knows the sport inside and out because she came from cycling. So that's great. But it's just we have to pause and think to ourselves, you know, have you ever heard a woman say, oh, I've appointed a male vice president? You know, we don't look at it that way. So that's why I don't want to look at it as like, oh, hey, that's great. We've got a woman VP. We need the right person for the job.
I appreciate that point, and you're absolutely right. It wasn't just throw any woman at it. I was obviously thinking somebody qualified who might not bring some of the baggage that seems to be attached to a lot of these other people. So let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with professional cyclist and producer of the movie Half the Road, Catherine Bertin. So I want to talk to you about some other things about the UCI, because the UCI is one of the biggest problems. And there are some rules and regulations that have been keeping women from both racing and earning a living as a professional cyclist. Can you sort of enumerate a couple of those?
Yeah, you know, I'll say that the biggest one, honestly, is this the infrastructure and kind of this chicken and egg cycle that we have, or in the film we call it the pentagram of blame. It was basically what we're saying is, you know, everybody has a side that they argue. So they'll say, oh, the women's sport isn't developed enough. And we'll say, well, wait a minute, why don't we have the same opportunities to show you how much we have developed? You know, why don't we have the same races? Why can't we race on the same courses as men? You know, and how come there isn't an equal prize purse? So everybody's blaming everybody else for why these things haven't come together. And I fully believe that the source of all of these problems is the UCI, because change has to come from the top down, you know, unless you want an entire peasant revolt. That's, you know, the only way to effectively create change is if the people at the very top of the organization believe in the people in that organization. So until we get someone at the top that says, hey, wait a minute, you know, let's make some changes here. Let's find a way to allow women to race at the same races, which in turn would give them the media exposure, you know, making sure that there's a package TV deal there like we had for La Course. And once there's TV and media exposure, then we get the sponsors. And once the sponsors come on board, they're going to bring money into the marketability angle of the sport. So these are the, you know, the trickle-down theories that we need, but it's got to start at the top. And this is, as we show in the film, like that's where we, you know, go after Cookson to make sure that these are things that need to happen.
I would like you to tell our listeners, relate to our listeners, your story about trying to get the points you needed to race in the 2012 London Olympics. It was quite a story.
So So to get to the Olympics, and so I, quickly I'll mention that I'm a dual citizen. So I represent the Caribbean island of St. Kitts and Nevis. And for any country that's never had a prior berth to the Olympics in cycling, the only way that they can qualify their country for the Olympics is to race on the UCI calendar and try to get a certain number of points that will vault them into the top 100 in the world. So that seems kind of cut and dry on paper. Okay, you got to get enough points to rank yourself in the top 100. My story personally was that I went to a couple different races and I got points, not quite enough that I needed to get into the top 100, but I was still trying. I was still trying to collect all the points that I could. And the points that I did have at that particular time were taken away because of an unknown rule. The Federation was supposed to send the points in, or the results in, within, 48 hours, and they didn't know that rule, and they sent them in, just past the 48-hour mark, and the UCI would not recognize the points. And that's something where, okay, there was a clerical error going on, within a federation, but it's the athlete that ends up getting penalized. You know, the results were not truly considered. So there are all these kind of areas that people don't know exist that end up, affecting somebody's dream or affecting somebody's Olympic hopes. So those are the kind of things we try to expose. Unfortunately, that was tough for me to see that happen. And I don't know if I'll be able to go again for 2016 because nothing's really changed in the point structure itself. So it would be a pretty difficult quest, but I'm always up for trying. So
being on the Wiggle Honda team may or may not give you the opportunity to race enough races still to get the number of points you need.
Well, one of the things that's tough in professional cycling is the rosters for these teams are often 16 people deep. If you're on a team of 16, but only six people race at a race, I might not be selected to go to all of those races. So now, that's another side of it. That's another aspect. And, I'll try to do everything that I can to get those points, but it's tricky because you can't get there without a team, yet you can't get there individually either.
Yeah, right. It's the catch 22.
Right. But I don't want to sound like I'm complaining without, offering some alternative suggestions. So, one of the things that I've tried to impress upon the UCI is for people that are in my position, which is, we represent a country that doesn't have a full-on women's national team, they could implement a structure for, say, time trialists, or they could revamp an Olympic point structure to specific areas of the world that are clustered, much like, say, the Caribbean islands, or they could have championships in place for smaller countries that are, that don't have to maybe go up against the big criteria system. So what that would do is you'd still need the top-notch best riders. We don't want to send anybody to the Olympics that isn't fully capable of being there and being the best.
Sure.
So, and I'm all for that. If I don't qualify for the game, that's fine. But what I want is the equal opportunity to try. And I want not just myself, but anybody out there that is at the professional level that should have that opportunity to go for their goals. That needs to be fair. So that is something that the UCI, I can break it down and say, hey, look, various things we can do here. We could create a time trial system. We could create, small area games and representations to have these cyclists shine. So there are plenty of ways to do it. Now we just have to get them to listen to me.
Yeah, and you're speaking pretty loudly in your movie. I'm speaking with Catherine Bertin. She is the producer and director of Half the Road, the documentary about women's cycling that is available now. We'll tell you at the end of our conversation how you can actually see it. I watched it this week, and it has one of my favorite people in it, Bob Roll. How did you get him to do that? That's cool.
I love when people ask me that question because the answer is I asked him.
Well, I guess my first question is, how did you find him to ask him? I've been looking to talk to Bob Roll for 2 years. I can't find him, but that just might be me.
You know, I just kind of waved the magic wand of our mutual connection. And I, you know, and one of my friends put me in touch with him, and he was fantastic. I sent him an email that outlined the project. I said, you know, very professionally, I'd like to hire you for this position. Can you, you know, could you talk to me about, you know, would you want to do this? And he immediately wrote back something along the lines of, like, you know, anything to support women's pro cycling.
Well, I know he's very much in favor of women's pro cycling. Unbelievable.
He really is. What I really loved about working with him is, you know, I mean, I wrote the actual script to the film, because that's what you do. You write it and somebody else narrates it. And so I wrote it and I sent it to Bob. And as he was reading through it, you know, he would offer, like, well, can I use a bigger adjective? You know, can I... Can I say outstanding instead of just good? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So it really showed his enthusiasm for the progress of the sport. And when he saw the movie, when he finally saw it, you know, all completed and put together, he just came up to me and he said, all right, Catherine, what are we doing next?
Oh, good for him. He's such a cool guy. But let's move on. I want to talk about something very special in the movie, because we're, you know, of course we got off on our own tangents, and that's perfect. I love it. But I want to talk about the part of the movie that deals with the young girls. So toward the end of the movie, you're showing youngsters, really young girls, 8 years old, 7 years old, who are starting to ride their bikes and thinking about things like, I want to ride in the Olympics. I mean, I never thought about that as a little girl, but I know I have a really good friend who was an ice skater as a little girl, and I'm sure that her goal was to be in the Olympics, you know? So tell us a little bit about what's happening with these young girls and how we can encourage more girls to ride and race.
Right. Well, I have to praise Leah Davison, our U.S. Olympic mountain biker extraordinaire. Leah and her sister, Sabra, put together the Little Bellas program that you're referencing in terms of the mountain biking. But this is the thing. So Leah has been in the sport. She's amazing. She's a role model. And she took it upon herself. She and her sister took it upon themselves to make a program like this happen. And that's what it takes. So what's absolutely amazing to me is that, you know, Leah's still competitive. She's still out there racing, and she's gotten this business off the ground of getting kids on bikes. So if she can do it, I know that we have more women cyclists that can also do this, whether it's while they're racing or after they retire. You know, but that's what we need. We need the change to come from within, and that's where all the growth and the progress is coming from, because Leah's standing in front of them as a mountain, as an Olympian, as living proof. Like, look, she did it. And so the kids look at her and they say, well, I want to do that.
Sure.
So that's what we have to do. And hopefully, you know, we all of us in the sport find a way to give back. You know, you give back through interviewing cyclists. Hopefully I'm giving something, you know, with the film.
Oh, you think?
And, well, you never know. They're always critics. They love to criticize people who do things.
Well, there is that, because, you know, there is another adage, they shoot champions.
Ah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and that goes back to Roman times. So let me end our conversation with a little bit of where you think the tipping point is. I think there's sort of this groundswell of change. What do you think it's going to take to push it over the edge?
I think that the tipping point is acknowledging the progress, but not resting on the laurels of that progress.
Oh, good. I like that.
That's what's gotten us into trouble in the past. You know, for example, people think that because we have Title IX effective, you know, for 40 years, they think that everything is equal, that everything's hunky-dory. In fact, the majority of society believes that women have a full Tour de France, because they just assume that if the men are doing it, the women are doing it too, right?
Right.
That's the conundrum, is that people are assuming that we have progressed far more than we have, and not just in cycling, but in other areas. You know, you could relate that to the fact that women make less money in their careers. Like, that's still going on. So what we have to do is find a way to keep being kind of loud and proud about the progress that we've made, but the fact that, hey, we're not there yet. And that's the tipping point, is finding a way to do that so that we don't come across sounding whiny or ungrateful, but rather acknowledging how far we've come, but how much more there is to go, but that we can get there if everybody is part of that collective voice.
So what's the next thing on your plate?
That's such a great question. I was hoping you could answer that for me. But what I'm actually, I am planning on racing through 2015, but the reality is that we all know that women in pro cycling don't have a lot of resources. They don't have a very big salary. So I'm constantly looking for work that I can do remotely, you know, around my training, that utilize either my editing or my social activism skills or my writing skills. So I'm on the job search usually this time of year, trying to find what's next. And that's where I am. I'm hopeful something will come up, but on the other side too, I'm still promoting the film and promoting the book that just came out this past September. So I'm keeping busy, but totally open for, you know, new experiences too.
Tell our listeners how they can get a copy of the book and or the film.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so you can go to my website, katherinebertine.com. You could go to the film's website, pasttheroad.com. And finally, we have a Facebook pages for both Half the Road and for The Road Less Taken, which is the name of the book. So you can just, you know, even throw it into Amazon. And you can also, if you don't want an actual DVD, download the film as well. That's available through Vimeo and iTunes, and it's all on our website, Half the Road, or you can just throw it into a search engine.
Well, Katherine, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a wonderful holiday and a happy, healthy, peaceful new year.
Oh, thank you so much, Diane. I appreciate all you do for our cycling community.
Thank you, and you have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Katherine Bertine joined me from her home in Arizona.
Couldn't ask for more enthusiasm, could you?
No, you could not. You could not. And as I said, I did enjoy the film. I thought it was very well produced. And, you know, Bob Roll. I mean, does it get better than Bob Key? No. Connie Carpenter Finney's in it. Inga's in it. Some beautiful women, just beautiful women. And boy, there's a lot of crashes in this film. Women take a beating just like the men do. And we are going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back with a little bit of news. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
Yes, you are. And do you have some news?
Yes, of course. We always have news.
Because there is always news.
So the first thing that I found was, and again, out of the Netherlands, smart bicycle has radar, vibrates when it senses obstacles.
Okay.
A new smart bicycle has been unveiled in the Netherlands, and its high-tech gadgetry might be the closest thing to a Pee Wee Herman bike on the market, but far less accident-prone. In fact, the bike's loaded with safety features and was designed specifically for the purpose of reducing high accident rate in the Netherlands, the bicycle-loving country. The bicycle, which is stated to officially go on sale within the next 2 years, sports a radar system mounted below the handlebars that can detect approaching obstacles, a small camera in the rear mudguard that keeps a watchful eye on your backside. When an obstacle approaches from the front or the rear, the system activates vibrating handlebars and a vibrating saddle to alert the rider to the impending danger. They also have a cradle that will attach that you can mount onto your handlebars that you mount a tablet or your smartphone, and it will have a flashing bright light that will also warn you the same.
Okay, then. Radar on your bike. This comes from the HuffPost, the third metric, redefining success beyond money and power. It's called Going the Distance. Passion propels cyclists despite rare genetic condition. What if your passion preserved your life? Would you think about it differently, even to the point of making it a priority? For Daryl Kuntz, whose passion for 20 years has been cycling, these questions are more than rhetorical musings. Every year, Daryl covers thousands of miles and competes in ultra-distance races in which he's won a handful of medals. For an amateur, though, it's an expensive sport. The gear, the training, traveling to compete. Daryl's justification was that being part of a community of enthusiasts and always challenging himself made it well worth the investment of time, money, and sweat. Then, one day, 5 years ago, Daryl found out just how important cycling was to his life. About 35 miles into a 60-mile brisk ride with friends, Daryl, who was 54 at the time, struggled to keep up with his companions as he cycled up a small hill. "I got winded and heard myself wheezing," he recalls. At first, doctors suspected exercise-induced asthma and possibly an issue with his heart, which led to 4 years of prescriptions for inhalers and follow-ups with cardiologists and other physicians. Finally, in June of this year, 2014, Daryl was diagnosed with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency alpha-1, a rare genetic form of COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. By the time he was diagnosed, Daryl's lung capacity was reduced to 58%. The number is startling for two reasons. First, he had been competing against cyclists with normal lung function and even won medals with the disease. And second, that number could have been, and perhaps should have been, far worse. If not for cycling, my lung capacity would be a lot lower, and I've been told by doctors that the loss could have happened so much sooner, he explains. Today, Daryl's 59. He receives intravenous drug treatment once a week to compensate for the fact that while his body does produce the protein he needs to protect his lungs from outside irritants, his liver doesn't process it. He's still cycling. A 60-mile ride is standard. A 100-mile ride is an enjoyable outing with a friend. Woo!
It's amazing that there are so many things that sometimes we ignore things that our body does.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it's amazing the things that we can overcome when our body isn't taking in the oxygen that we need and everything else. And it makes it really challenging. And it's great to see that he's on the right track as far as not fixing it, but coping with it better.
Right. All right. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution from December 18th. And it's a very exciting article because our friend Jackie Crowell had a clear scan. The one-time Olympian cycling hopeful is competing against the cruelest of opponents, brain cancer. And she appears to be in the lead. Her oncologist recently detected no trace of a tumor discovered and removed last year. Crowell has decided to do something even more reckless than cycling in a pack at 40 miles an hour. She has embraced hope. "I have a chance," she said last week in the kitchen of her Kirkwood home. "I'm going into the holidays not thinking that this is my last Christmas." And she took it a step further. "I would love to turn 30, said Crowell, who is 26. "It would be a blessing to turn 30. Isn't that awesome?
It's a great story.
Yep.
And again, what's great is, again, on Twitter, she shares so much of everything that she's going through and her trials and her successes and everything else. And it's great to support her and go along the journey with her.
Right. You got one more?
Just one more. And this is a reminder. This is from the National Safe Kids Organization. If you're going to give somebody a bicycle this year, make sure you give them a helmet as well, especially with the kids.
What an interesting idea.
Well, so many times we seem to forget.
One more item to add to that. So if you are giving a child the gift of a bicycle for the very first time, and it's his first or her first two-wheeler, do not put the training wheels on. Remove the pedals. Put the seat all the way down and let the child push the bike around like a little scooter with his feet or her feet until they get the balance, you will never need training wheels. Training wheels are terrifying because they tip and you always think you're going to fall over. So you don't need training wheels. You can do it by taking the pedals off the bike, putting the seat all the way down, letting them get the idea of what balance feels like, and then you put the pedals on and boom, off they go.
That makes it entirely too simple.
Sorry. On that note, I think we are going to go on over to over the pond, as they say.
Yes.
And we're going to go over to England and we're going to talk with Mark Cleanthus, the author of Triathlon, The Mental Battle. He is one triathlete. Mark, thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Thank you for inviting me.
How's England today?
It's quite mild, actually, at the moment. It's about 12, 13 degrees. We normally have about 4 or 5 degrees, and it's normally frosty, which makes you feel more Christmassy. But it's been recently mild, so hopefully we get a bit of a cold snap, so I feel more like Christmas.
We're going to talk about your new book, Triathlon, The Mental Battle. And I really like the approach because we are talking about mind over a lot of the other things that people tend to focus on, which is body and training and eating and everything else. And while all of that's important, it is the mental battle that you really have to sort of wage to become a really good athlete, I think. So tell us a little bit about your background. I know that you've done over 1,050 triathlons and marathons and ultra distance events, but just sort of give us a little bit of background on you.
When I was 10, I finished last in a school break cross country race, and my teacher said, "Mark, you never run a marathon." And so I stopped getting the bus to school, and I used to run to school and run back. And then next time we had a cross country race, I was third but last. So that was a great improvement for me. And so for 10 years, I just kept running and didn't really think about running in any marathon. Then I heard about the first London Marathon in 1981, so I signed up for that and managed to get in the first year, and I just got the bug for long distance endurance events, and then I was running to work and running back, and then I started cross training with alternating with cycling to work and back one day, and then cycling, running the next day, and then I might cycle in, run home, and then run home, run to work the next day, then cycle home. And so I got the bug for marathons, got pretty into marathons, running up to 10 a year. And then I heard about triathlon, so I just had to learn how to swim.
Wow.
And that was back in 1983. I've just finished my 31st consecutive year competing in triathlons. And I've now done 37 Ironman races, plus some double Ironman and triple Ironman races, which took me 45 hours, 58 minutes and 29 grueling seconds, all without stopping.
What kind of a person is able to complete the number of events you have? And I'm not saying you've never been injured or you've never been sick, but you've been able to do a 45-hour event is just mind-boggling to me. So do you think that there's something very special about you?
Well, genetically, being last in a school breast cross country race, I didn't have the genetic genes. I didn't have a high VO2 max or a good pain threshold at that time. But I think over years, I developed a positive mental attitude to allow me to be enthusiastic for 35 years, to always look for new ways to improve my nutrition, my rest and recovery, the way I train, learn more about myself, and therefore I think that's definitely helped me with everything in life. You know, mental attitude, being fit in sport has allowed me to give me more energy in life, and just a quest for new adventures, new horizons each and every day.
Well, you did write a book called The Complete Book of Triathlon Training, which is sort of a Bible, but the new book really focuses on how to be a better athlete by taking control of your mind. So in your first chapter, you talk about what happens to the mind during these events. What kinds of things do happen?
Well, what happens is endorphins are naturally produced. I mean, they're released via the pituitary gland at the base of the brain to block out feelings of pain, and they basically block out discomfort, And that's why sport is so addictive, I think. These natural endorphins can make you feel exhilarated and can result in an athlete's high. You generally, before a race, we get excited, we get the adrenaline kicking in, we want to go to the bathroom more often. But we have to make sure we don't confuse excitement with fear. They're both very similar. They make us hot and sweaty, they raise the heart rate. But if you confuse one with the other, then one's going to give you a great performance and the other one's going to give you a very disappointing performance. When we exercise, for example, you know, hormone imbalances affect anxiety. They can either help you or they can make you nervous. There's obviously many different hormones that affect the brain chemistry and the neurotransmitter production. But these all keep the brain in balance. So you have to make sure you take control. And by taking control, it's using adrenaline, which is a fight or flight hormone. I mean, that's essential to increase the heart rate, make sure you've got good muscle tension, make sure the anxiety, you know, occurs in the body under long-term stress for the event, but obviously make sure it doesn't continue into everyday life, because that can just spiral and cause further anxiety symptoms. I mean, I certainly believe the biggest improvements in human performance in the future will come from untapping the potential of the human mind. And that's why, you know, I've written the triathlon, The Mental Battle, because it's all about effective coping strategies. It's not about making you tougher. It's just about overcoming, you know, those fears. So, for example, if you've rehearsed during a cycling event, you fall off your bike or you get a puncture or something. If you've done it time and time again mentally, when it happens in the event, you know what to do. You know that, you know, you've got to get back on your bike, make sure the bike is safe, and then cycle off. But don't cycle off like Greg LeMond or someone else that's really fast. Just gradually build up. Use that adrenaline, but don't use it up all at once.
Interesting. That's an interesting point. So you begin to ease back into it and use the adrenaline to your advantage.
Athletes that have crashed, or runners that have fallen over, the ones that have taken their time to get back up and think about, you know, am I okay, building up slowly, generally have sometimes gone on to win a race when possibly they wouldn't have won it had they not, you know, fallen over or crashed.
Yeah, interesting. Let me remind people, we're speaking with Mark. We're going to try this Cleanthus. Yes?
That's correct.
About his new book, Triathlon, The Mental Battle. Mark has way more races under his belt than almost anybody I've ever spoken with in the past. You talk about visualizing a problem and overcoming it, and you also talk about taking control of the brain left and right, or two halves. So we talk about that in yoga too. Explain about taking control, what you mean by that.
Okay. Taking control. The only way you can take control of your mind is by understanding how the mind works. The left side, for example, of the brain thinks about pre and post race. Did I take in enough calories? Did I pace myself? Was I prepared for the hills? The left side goes into autopilot when we're learning new skills, for example. So the right side is more sensitive to emotional fears. So you really have to concentrate on the right side. And the issue we have is in today's frenetic 24/7 fast pace, you know, the world that we live in with the internet, fantastic podcasts to listen to and those sort of things, we fail to achieve our potential because we're so busy with, you know, information overload, you know, because of a busy mind. And so we don't necessarily need to find more time to develop the mind and overcome these fears and understand how the right and the left side work, but we need to understand how we can help ourselves and what type of thinker we are. So I mean, fear, for example, let's discuss fear initially. Fear is either a real fear or it's an unreal fear. If it's a real fear, it's our own body's defense mechanism to the current situation or future danger. If it's an unreal fear, it comes from our own imagination. You know, so if we're swimming in a lake, are there sharks? You know, if we're cycling up a hill, miles from anywhere, are there bears going to come out and jump on our back? So obviously it's possible, but these are generally unlikely hindrance or distractions from our fears, and it could be that there's some other fear that we need to control. So once you understand what side of the brain that's taking control, then you can use specific ways. And some of these I use with my clients or coach, and some people have given me feedback from the triathlon, the mental battle, and said that these have been quite useful. So if we divide the brain into two hemispheres, the left and the right, as I said before, each side processes information in a completely different way. And once you decide which is your dominant side, you can work on controlling your fears. So the left brain really focuses on list makers. So if you tend to be, you like lists, you like scheduling, you like making checklists, you like ticking off tasks and completing them, then you're likely to be a left brain dominant thinker. So you need to look and examine at the problem step by step before completing the task. So if you're worrying about getting to the top of a hill, for example, when you're cycling, you need to break down the hill into small sections. And if the elevation's the same, 8%, 10%, all the way up, and you've done a quarter of the way up, then you know that you can get to the top. But if you're a lefty, if you think more from the left side of the brain, then you've got to use words. So the left brain individuals need street names and times. So it's just a clever way of working out when you're looking to descend a hill, what type of things should you think about. If you're better to disassociate sometimes, but concentrate on going downhill than focusing on the task at hand.
You know, you use things like visualization and positive self-imagery. There are a lot of things that I think people overlook about their own personalities when they begin to do races. They're looking at their power output and their distances and how fast they are in the water, and they're forgetting the most important thing, and that is, you know, who they are as a person and how they might react in a certain situation. One of the chapters I found interesting was chapter 6, because it begins with your age, and it's about stress factors and how to use them to your advantage. So as we get older, what kinds of things can we expect to change, and then what can we use to our advantage as we get older?
Well, as we get older, we've got a much bigger toolbox of lifestyle experiences, you know, cycling in the cold, cycling in the heat, cycling over different conditions, maybe having 3 or 4 punctures and those sort of things. So you've just, because you've got a bigger, much bigger armory of experiences, you know, like me, for example, I've competed in 1,050 races and worldwide, from freezing cold temperatures to extreme heat, so 120 degrees in the Sahara Desert. It's unlikely that I've not experienced it in a race or in training. So I'm much better at pacing myself. I'm better at the correct type of clothing. I'm very good at knowing what clothing suits me. Now, it doesn't suit, I'm quite slight, you know, 5% body fat, so I know I need to wear more clothes. I'm quite happy to perspire when I'm out cycling, for example, or doing an endurance event, where if someone sweats a lot, maybe they don't need as many clothes. I competed faster than an Ironman in Sweden in 2012, age 51, than I did 25 years before, back in 1987, when I was 26. So I understand my limiters. I understand that I have to keep an even pace. Sometimes I need to ignore my heart rate monitor or my power meter because I'm feeling better than the information's telling me. Sometimes I need to back off because my heart rate may be low, but I'm feeling quite tired. I listen to my body. Do I take on some drink or do I take on some energy food? And if that helps me, I know that's what I need to concentrate on. If I take on liquid and it doesn't really satisfy my thirst, maybe I need to just slow down a little bit or take some more nutrition in. So there's lots of ways when you're older you can use that as an advantage. I certainly pace myself better now. I don't go off as fast.
Sure.
I'm more successful at the end of a race now, I believe, than I ever was. And I'm not worried when someone overtakes me on the bike, or, you know, I just think, well, I'll stick to my pace. If they slow down, I'll beat them, because I won't slow down. If I stay with them, I'm likely to blow up, and we both might blow up and slow down. So being older can be, I see as a positive. I know a lot of athletes that are older actually work on perception of effort, and they ignore heart rate. They don't use power meters. And if you look back at the Ironman that's held in Hawaii every year, you know, the times aren't any really much quicker when you consider, you know, better technology on bicycles, better nutrition. You know, some athletes now have a mental coach, a nutrition coach, a core conditioning coach. They have bike fits. They have a whole conundrum of experts helping them. Sometimes I think they're not getting back to grassroots and looking at what Mark Allen and Dave Scott did. Well, they didn't have, I was there racing against them. They didn't have a computer. They didn't have heart rate monitors. They just worked on feel, and they worked on their limiters.
I like that a lot. I agree. I understand exactly what you're saying, that all of these external things may or may not make you a better athlete if you don't know yourself. Once again, we're talking with Mark Kleanthis. He is the author of Triathlon, The Mental Battle. It's a really interesting book because it doesn't tell you to go out and get a power meter. It tells you more about how to work with yourself to know your own mind and to take some positive steps with it. Let's talk about motivation for a second. So, you know, some days you just don't want to get up and run or ride or swim or whatever it is. What kinds of suggestions do you have for an athlete who's training for an event and experiences burnout or lack of motivation?
Well, when an athlete struggles with motivation, it may be that they're doing too much training. They're not enjoying it. You don't need to overthink, but you do need some me time. And sometimes me time is not having 60 minutes to train and training for 60 minutes. It might be some, you know, yoga or stretching before or after the workout. It might be doing a slightly easier training session so you can just switch off your mind and you can go into automatic pilot. Having benchmark sessions between now and your next competition can help. Rather, if you're always trying to go faster each and every time, you're more likely to burn yourself out. And if you burn yourself out or you're just trying too hard, that's going to take the fun out of it. And remember, that's why most of us do it. We don't do it to earn a living. We do it to enjoy it. And that's either the training, the journey to get there, or when we're actually in the competition.
You also talk about, and I thought this was one of the coolest things in the book, you have an A to Z of negative words. Why do you have that in there, and what are you trying to get across with that?
Right. Negative words can be, well, they just, I believe they just drag you down. I mean, most people have two or three words that can actually raise the heart rate, or it can make you more stressed. So, you know, you really need to think about, you know, people that may be having cancer and just struggling from day to day, or they're physically challenged. You can look at those words and think, what, rather than give people options, I actually left the options open. So when we're looking at negative words, reject, you know, or it could be, you know, it could be afraid, or it could be angry or anxious. If you're anxious, you should expect to be anxious. That's going to help you during the event. You shouldn't be afraid. The whole point of doing an event is to overcome your fears or overcome your challenges. It's good to be frightened, but I believe afraid is a bigger word than frightened. Apprehensive is good because that's getting your body ready. If you're apprehensive, you're more likely to not go off too fast. You're more likely to pace yourself.
So you're taking these negative words and giving them a different charge, so meaning that they're less negative to you. So one of the ones I thought was a really interesting word is the word atrocious, and which is an awful word, but you've changed it to testable or terrible, so it just doesn't have such an impact and feel so awful.
Yes, and obviously the more times you use atrocious, the more you're going to feel comfortable with that word. But
true.
If you can use detestable or terrible, that may just, for you, that may conjure up less. The weather isn't atrocious. It's just, it's
well, you're
just,
not living,
you know,
in Cleveland. It's pretty atrocious sometimes.
Okay. Well, okay. They're the days you need to go out if you can, and just and then when you come to a race, it's maybe just detestable or just, you know, just terrible. Sometimes, you know, the word can't, you know, cannot or are unable to or possibly not, then those sort of words conjure up. There's a slight opportunity, a slight chance that I can, you know, cold, you know, if you're really cold, well, then maybe think of how warm you're going to be when you finish and you can jump in the car afterwards or having a warm bath afterwards.
Right, right. Interesting. Well, the book is, again, Triathlon, The Mental Battle, How to Be a Better Athlete by Taking Control of the Mind by Mark Kleanthas. He's a coach. He's a motivational speaker. And he is an endurance athlete. So he speaks from a lot of experience, way more than many, many other people we've spoken with in the past. So, Mark, let people know how they can get a copy of the book. It is. I know you're in England, but they can get the book probably here in the States.
You can get it from Barnes and Noble, or you can get it through Amazon or any great book or bookstore or triathlon store. I thoroughly recommend it as the author. I was working out the other day that I've swam nearly 7,000 miles, cycled 180,000 miles, and run 54,000 miles.
Oh, that's my goodness. That's
240,000 miles. That's to the moon, but not back. So I'm looking at the positive side. I'm only halfway there, really. You can get a book direct from me with your own personalised signed copy from my website, which is ironmate.co.uk, or through the publishers Mayer and Mayer. And anyone can follow me on Twitter at IronMateMark. And I follow you and you follow me, so it's let's get a few more followers.
We'll put a link up to your IronMate website on our Facebook page. And
excellent, that's right.
I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me before the holidays. I hope you have a wonderful holiday and a happy new year and a great race season coming up in 2015.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mark. And again, have a good evening. Thanks for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mark Kleanthas spoke with us from his home in the UK. Boy, that's a lot of miles, 200 and some odd thousand, to the moon and on his way back.
That explains his 5% body fat.
Yeah, I don't want to go there.
I'm curious to see if we're getting to a point where we're actually going to be able to have a measuring of mentally, if you can be successful in an event mentally as opposed to physically.
That's interesting. How to measure mental. Oh, what an interesting idea. Well, the book is nice. It's beautifully written. It's put together really well. It gives you some great tools to use to kind of form your mind in a positive way. You know, negative thoughts are not a good thing. They tend to sabotage what you're doing. So that is our show for this week. We are going to have a little bit different show next week. We're not sure what it is yet because it is the holiday and Tim and I are taking those days off. I think Greg has something planned, so we might not be back until 2 weeks. If you have a chance, go for a ride. Please have a happy, healthy, safe, and peaceful holiday. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.